Hi, everyone. It's the Retro Computing Roundtable, Show 10.
And my world has changed back.
This is the show where retro computer fanatics come to the table and discuss news and items of interest to the retro computing community. I'm Earl Evans, the host of the RetroBits podcast in currently sunny, but not for long, Portland, Oregon. And I'm joined on the show by Carrington Vanston from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Carrington's the host of the 1 MHz, the Apple II podcast. Hi there, Carrington.
Hello, Earl.
How are you today?
Fantastic, and it is sunny and beautiful here in Toronto.
Awesome. It's sunny here, but I hear that it's going to be rainy pretty soon. So what are you expecting over the next few days up there in Canada?
Rain. It's been raining almost every day the last couple of weeks. So we're a small break today and then another full week of rain, I think they're calling for.
We've had this weird situation where it's been sunny on the weekdays and then rainy on the weekends. And I think it's killing the people who do outdoor activities and sports and that kind of thing. But
well, I'm in Canada, so if it's not snowing, I'm a happy guy.
Also on the podcast, we have David Grealish from Johns Creek, Georgia. David is the host of the Classic Computing Video Podcast and Stan Veit's History of the Personal Computer Audiobook Podcast. Hey there, David.
Hey, Harold. It's a mouthful, huh?
It's a lot of stuff, but it's good stuff. How are you doing today?
Thanks. I'm doing really good. I just pulled up my weather here so I could join in that conversation. But looking out the window, it's beautiful here in north of Atlanta, Georgia. So it's supposed to be like 89 degrees. It's sunny and clear. So great weekend. Looks like we're sticking with the weather here. We're clear through tomorrow with partly cloudy skies. And I only have the 36-hour update, so that's it. We're mostly sunny through Sunday.
So it's going to be beautiful days outside for all three of us, and we're inside talking about computers.
Yes.
Okay.
Not just computers, but old computers.
Right, yes.
Hey, somebody's got to do it, though. Wow, I am really jealous of your weather there, David. But, you know, it's summer's coming. We always have beautiful summers in Portland. So that's what keeps us here for the other 9 months. Somebody says, you know, when do you really experience summer in Portland? I said, well, you know, last year it was on a Tuesday. So,
and it's not like Seattle, right? It's not overcast and gray skies most of the time or whatever. Or that's what Seattle, I hear, is.
No, usually the summers here are beautiful blue. They're warm. You know, it's not uncommon to have days in the 90s and kind of like the weather that it sounds like you're currently experiencing mm-hmm. there. So I'm looking forward to it.
The difference here is the humidity. So even though this is far north mm-hmm. of where I'm from in Florida, it's still, you know, cousin the south, you know, and humid.
Well, so you guys may have noticed that I'm behind the host microphone today, if you will. David has, probably for the first and last time allowed me to take the captain's chair for the podcast here. So we'll see how it goes. But anyway, we do have some items of interest, some great news to discuss today. And first up on those topics in the discussion area here, we've got the Maker Hackerspace movement. And I think you put this up there, David, so why don't I turn that over to you to tell us about it?
Okay. Thanks, Earl. And, you know, this is a lot of fun for me being on, this side of the microphone. We're all on the same side of the microphones, but, you know, being a kind of a regular panelist versus the host now, so this is kind of fun. Not that it wasn't fun the other way around, but I think I've brought this up before, and maybe in another show about the Arduino. You know, there's this sort of movement going on around the country and I guess the world too with hacker spaces and people sort of, building. And this carries over into mechanical as well as electronic kits and things. So there's this hacker space movement of hacker spaces where people, you know, build things and hack things together. And I think even the term hacker isn't a negative word anymore. You know, a hacker is a bad person that breaks into systems and steals and causes damage. And originally the term was someone who did interesting things to make things work in software.
Yeah, and I think with these hacker spaces, it's really more a return to the original sense of hackers and the phone freaks and the train line freaks and that kind of stuff. Freaks with PH, of course. So, I'm not trying to be insulting.
So I think the parallel I was thinking about and I was looking at is it occurred to me that just maybe a little bit this, and also just to explain the maker movement, because there's Make Magazine, and so that there's maker fairs and people doing these hacker space sort of things. So it seems to me that there's at least somewhat of a parallel of modern microcontroller computing, which would be like the Arduino microcontroller processor, which I'm real new to, but I'm just starting to get into it. And then what went on, of course, in the mid-70s with the homebrew computer movement, if you will, you know, microcomputing, and the homebrewers and so on. So I just thought I'd make an interesting discussion, and it enlightened some people. And, you know, I ordered my first Arduino recently, and did I put a link on here? Yeah, the last one, and of course, these will be in the show notes, from a little company called NKC Electronics. So I bought the free Duino. And so are either of you familiar with Arduinos? And
yep, I have a kit.
Oh, you do? Okay. And I know, Earl, didn't you do some stuff with Parallax, the propeller and that sort of thing in the past?
Exactly. I played a lot with the propeller chip from Parallax. Yeah. It's interesting you mention that, because this weekend they're having the unofficial Propeller Expo. I think that it's in Rockland, California. And, you know, they've done this, I don't know, is this the third year? I can't remember exactly, but Jeff Ledger, the fellow who actually hosts the Petsky forums, where you'll find the Retrobits forums among other many Commodore-related forums, organizes that, at least he has in the past. I don't know if he's doing it this year, but it's interesting the enthusiasm and the creativity and all those, what would you say, you know, experimental juices are flowing around these kind of hobby projects. I think it gives people an opportunity to actually get their hands on something that they can understand. Rather than, you know, I've mentioned it before on Retrobits, how modern computing platforms are so incredibly complex. You know a niche of a niche of a niche of a niche, and you're lucky if you know that. You know, whereas the old systems, you could know the whole thing. And I think this takes us back to some of that.
And Earl, you're truly, aren't you a programmer? Are you a programmer by profession?
Not by profession, no. I'm just, I guess, you know, hearkening again back to that word, I'd call myself a hacker. You know, I like to program self-taught, you know, stuff in .NET. And,
okay, yeah, well, that's still more advanced than... So I guess where I was going with this is, for me, somebody who's, you know, early on took some, you know, fooled around in BASIC a little bit. I took a couple of programming courses in college, which I didn't do very well at. I am in no way a programmer. I think... there's been a microcontroller sort of movement going on that you've been a part of with the propeller, and I think even before that in the 90s, what was kind of the predecessor to the propeller? Parallax made it. I can't think of it, but...
just the basic stamp.
Yeah, basic stamp.
Yes, that's it.
But I think those devices are definitely more advanced, and I think what the Arduino has brought to the table is a, you know, mere mortal like me, someone who really doesn't... I couldn't do the things you know how to do. This has now opened up a frontier for me to... mess around with microcontrollers, regular people more so. So I think, is that true, do you think?
I think that it is very approachable. And I think, you know, the combination of the Arduino platform and what they call the shields, right, where you've got these circuit boards with different capabilities, like you might have an Ethernet shield, or you might have a A to D converter shield, or, you know, things that you can plug compatible with that platform, and you don't have to go out and build it all yourself. You know, you can plug these modules in, and then you can program them and do cool things with them, and make the blinking lights flash, and it's lots of fun. I hear people all the time having great fun with these. Not only having fun with these in isolation, but in a lot of cases, hooking these up to their vintage computers and
there's
making
people
kind
doing
of an,
projects with them for old computers.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I think one of the other elements of the appeal is just the low economic barrier to entry. I mean, you can get into a little maker hobby or Arduino thing for, you know, $20-$30, and you've got everything you need to start playing around, versus a computing hobby. And if you want to play with a different platform, it can be thousands of dollars to get into that.
So my free Duino, I got it for $23, I think, plus, you know, like $28 out the door. And if you go to – so these links will be in the show notes. So if you go to the Arduino Wikipedia link – you'll go through about halfway down. You'll see an official Arduino. See if I can say this right. Due Milanov. But anyway, that's like the, I guess, the current Arduino-branded board. But anyway, there's a link to my free Duino, which is essentially a clone of that one. So really what Arduino is just a little microcontroller, a little computer, and the shields you mentioned, Earl, are simply, it has a plug in the top, and you plug a shield. It's just something that gives it extra connections to do specialized things. I think that's it, right?
Exactly. No? You can add like a little LCD or Ethernet, as Earl said, that kind of stuff.
And just to close this out, the reason I'm wanting to do this is I've had a sort of, I like to call it a piece of art I have in mind, but it's a retro computing sort of an art project that I've always wanted to do. And essentially, here it is I want to make, imagine like a large picture, you know, a picture that you'd put over a sofa or something. So maybe, I don't know, 3 foot by 3 foot, could be square, rectangle. So it's a picture you would hang in a living room or something. But essentially, it replicates the look of what figure like a 1950s reel-to-reel computer tape, kind of the classic what you think of an old computer looking like, with blinking lights and the reel-to-reels going back and forth and stuff.
Nice.
You know what I'm saying? But imagine it's as a work of art in this picture frame. So you hang it up on the wall, and the lights are blinking, and the reels are going back and forth, switching. You know, so it gives you this feel of this old computer. And so I want to learn how to build the little controller to make the blinking lights and the little reels do their thing.
And maybe you can get a shield that gives it the voice of Colossus.
Yeah.
Wow, you actually remember that movie.
Of course, I love that movie. This is the voice of Colossus. This is the voice of World Control.
Oh, you can watch it on YouTube. I watched it recently. And maybe Netflix, I'm not sure, but I ended up watching it on YouTube. So.
Yeah, I love the Forbin Project.
Yeah.
I've read all three of the books as well now.
Let me put that in the show notes.
Yeah, absolutely. I've only read the first book, and you know that movie had an incredible effect on me as a young man.
Me too. Mm-hmm.
And so I should definitely read the other works.
It's interesting how the lead character Forbin in the books is so much more of a 60s sort of guy. You know, it's a little more hunky, a little less nerdy, and it's still that basic idea of, you know, man as like humanity against one or eventually two computers and stuff. And yeah, all three books are interesting. Even what's the third one? Colossus and the Crab. Yeah, they're definitely worth reading if you're interested in the topics.
Cool. I've got some summer reading now. So did we want to move on to the article by Stan Veit? What do you guys think?
Yeah, I guess so.
Sure.
Since we'll just go in order, I guess, of the notes here. So really, sure. In trying to come up with topics for the show, I kind of went a little, I did some searches online for some things going on, which later we're going to talk about just the different vintage computer festivals, just coverage, basic coverage. But, you know, I have a number of Computer Shopper magazines that I've collected, and I really love to sit down and just flip through these, as well as a lot of older computer magazines. So I came upon, you know, and I have a bit of a connection with Stan Veit, you know, doing his book as an audio book, and then I've met him, and you know, he was the editor and publisher of Computer Shopper. So I was flipping through, and I found this editorial in Computer Shopper from April 1989, and it just was interesting. I think there's some interesting parallels here, so I'm just going to read a quick bit of it and see what you guys think. So it's called SAA versus Standalone PC Applications. So again, remember, this is April. This is 12 years ago, 22 years ago, right? Almost exactly. So this is pre-internet. And people certainly were online, but just not in the way you think of it today. Obviously, pre-cloud computing and everything. He says, I do not often comment on other editors' editorials, but I found the one by Fred Langa, editor-in-chief of Byte, in the February issue to be very interesting. Apparently, he was at an IBM briefing where they discussed their vision of System Application Architecture, SAA, and their view of the future. IBM sees a world of computing where a mainframe computer will be the repository of all information, and it will be accessed by lesser computers and terminals using their SQL capabilities through a system of networks. All would support the common SAA and use a common user interface, a common programming interface, a common communications interface, and common applications, all part of the common system. Now, I scanned this in, and so it's fully in the show notes as a link. But does that sound familiar?
Oh, sure. This same argument comes up every decade, basically, where there'll be the one image of computing as being centralized and the current image of perhaps computing going cloud-based.
Yeah.
But it was in the 60s with the mainframes. It's like over and over again, the idea, there's been that tug of war between between the image of computing as something that's centralized, that you use something a little dumber to tap into, or something that is distributed and everybody has a standalone powerful thing that are simply networked. Clearly, the way we've gone is really the image that Stan had of individually more powerful computers that are sharing a network rather than dumb terminals. And I have never bought into the dumb terminal space. I've always been on the side of the let's give everybody more powerful computers and network them together. So my side is winning so far.
Well, just to, I'll read just a couple other quick segments out of the article. So to Stan's credit, he responds slightly later on. He says, so he doesn't agree with this. He says, the principal differences with the IBM vision and the real world is that 85% of the computer users do not need that mainframe storehouse of knowledge and never will. The inexpensive super PC with its 8386 or 8046 CPU, supported by megabytes of RAM and gigabytes of high-speed disk storage, is perfectly capable of serving as a repository of programs or data for a network of almost equal computers and peripherals, which is exactly what came to be. And I think what Google and Wikipedia and all these were built on, you know, essentially basic regular computers. Of course, now I guess they use, you know, Blade servers and all that kind of stuff. But then near the end, he says, IBM will not be able to control the flow of information through owning the universal software system any more than they can control the manufacture of computers by owning the bus they run on.
But to play devil's advocate, as much as I've always been on Stan's side in this article, I think we're at a point in computing now where much different than previous decades, you do have the general public interested generally in computers in a social aspect. And that's what's new.
That's
and the reality
too.
Is we do gather all that information in a central mainframe called Facebook or, you know, so I think it could be, and now maybe it just Facebook is AOL 2.0, but who knows? It might be that we are on the verge of a paradigm shift in computing. We'll see, because
absolutely.
I think people are using them differently, but it's so hard to predict how these things will go.
And in fact,
certainly I never would have predicted we'd end up here from 1989.
It's two-tier, in fact, because not only is the social networking huge, but then also the entertainment, you know, moving to the net, movies and television shows and all that, you know, versus traditional ways that we got that.
It's a funny dichotomy, the difference between, I mean, we were just talking about hackerspaces and the idea of the old homebrew clubs and stuff. And I totally agree that those are basically the same thing separated by 25 or 30 years. But those are often about the niche people, the people like us, the hackers, the nerds, the computer lovers, and people that grew up spending all their time in their parents' basements taking apart VCRs and learning to write code. But we approach and use and think about computers maybe on a fundamentally different level than, say, my sister would or the general public would, who is, it's not about, oh, how cool, look at the number of transistors here, but instead it's like, oh, look how I can share photographs of my friends and what we did on the weekend and stuff. And maybe that will, I mean, there's so many more people who are interested in that than maybe in the way I approach computers. It could have a fundamentally massive change in the computing landscape.
Well, and you know, I think that it might not be either all the way to the left or all the way to the right how this pans out.
Oh, we're going to have the voice of reason now, are we?
I hate to do it, but I was just thinking about, you know, our company that I work for makes heavy use of cloud-based computing resources, things like Amazon Web Services and Salesforce. And, you know,
your company hacked the PlayStation Network?
We didn't.
Uh-huh. We have an admission.
But the interesting thing is, though, people couldn't get their job done day to day without their PCs either. I also think about my son, you know, who loves, he's got, you know, an iTouch, and he loves the ability to go out there and get his email and all those other things that are hosted out on the cloud, if you will. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, he's got this game that he loves. It's called Nova, and it is a first-person shooter, you know, that you go into a group. You know, it's a net game, you know, and you go in collaboratively and you go. So have you played that one?
Yes, I have. Good one.
He loves that game. So, but here's the thing. You couldn't play that game, I don't think, on a dumb terminal per se. You need the computing resources that are in the iTouch in order to be able to play the game. You need the gyroscope. You need the accelerometer. You need the GPU. But on the other hand, you also couldn't play that game as effectively without the quote-unquote cloud. Mm-hmm. Because without the cloud, there wouldn't be a gathering spot. There wouldn't be,
the nature of the game itself requires that. Yeah,
exactly. So I think, computing, especially with the proliferation of devices all over and mobile devices, it's going to be an amalgam. There's going to be the cloud and there's going to be local computing. And anybody who tries to strip all the power out of either one of those ends of the equation is probably going to lose.
That's exactly right, because what has changed from traditional terminal, a terminal, obviously, when I'm talking to people who about like, oh, here's an old computer, and I explain to them that this is a terminal. This is not a display like you think of. It doesn't display video or graphics. It's simply displaying, it's the computer sends ASCII, 255 different characters to it and displays those. So that's what's different is now you have modern computers that are full-on computers with graphical power and computing power, but they're still reliant on this even bigger pipeline of data that's centralized or has to be controlled in some central area. Right? Did I explain that, I think, correctly? The massive parallel games or whatever. You're right. It's a combination of both paradigms, I guess.
And there's some huge advantages to, as much as if your cloud storage goes away, that's terrible. If they shut down, if Flickr vanishes, maybe people's photos are lost. But I use Dropbox all the time, and it's so convenient to have my documents local and also backed up immediately to the net for free, and I can get at them from anywhere else and share them from my other devices. So there's a lot of cloud advantages now because the data has become so big, but so have our pipes. So having that stuff move around, and I think there's going to be a big push from media companies to really move towards that and say, why do you want to own a movie and have it locally? Wouldn't you just rather pay us every time you want to watch it and we'll stream it to you and you don't get to own anything? And I think media companies are majorly pushing for that direction, and that will probably have quite an influence on the development of cloud computing.
And I never agreed with that concept. That concept, just on the surface, like that's stupid. Like, because I'm an iPod user for many years. I own all my music. So for many years, I was of the. And there's some other companies I think that did the subscription based, where you don't own anything. You, as long as you
and
pay
like
us
Spotify,
every month. You can have access to all the music in the world. And of course, that concept to me was like, BS on that. I want my music. But so now what's changed in my life and my family's life, we rarely buy DVDs. Mm-hmm. Almost never buy them anymore because they sit on our shelves, take up space, and it's just almost not worth it anymore unless you really, really care about the movie. But we subscribe to Netflix, and we go
use those
dollar rentals at the Redbox and the Blockbuster thing, and really that works out really great.
Exact same experience. Like internally and emotionally, I have resisted very strongly the idea that I won't own my own media. And that's been buoyed up, and the fire under that has been lit a lot, for me to mix all my metaphors here, by ideas of when I put a DVD that I own into a DVD player that I own connected to a TV that I own, and I pick up my remote control, and I press fast forward, and it says not permitted. And I get so irate at that. I'm like, not permitted by whom? I own this. I can do whatever I want with this movie.
I think my wife has to calm me down when that happens. Go easy, I approach the DVD player with a hammer.
Exactly. So, that what got me, that's why all my movies, I might buy the DVD, but they're all ripped. They're all sitting on a just a media center here I can access however I want. But that also eased me into the idea that I just want sort of everything that I want on tap, and I just stream it locally.
That's the key.
I got Netflix just like you, and while up here in Canada, it's a smaller service. It's still amazing, and I can't believe the value I get out of that for $8 a month or something. But I also subscribe to zip.ca, which is the DVDs in the mail one, and because I occasionally just want to watch something or to support the other podcast I do. And so I'm easing into the idea, like slowly. I'm like the lobster in a pot, and it's just getting a little warmer. So I'm easing toward the idea that it's okay to have things streaming, and maybe having all the music in the world just stream to me wherever I want it is nice. But I worry about what I give up in return when I give up the idea that I own my own things, because I just don't trust companies that do own intellectual property to play fairly with me later and not say, oh no, remember originally it was stream, it was this much, and now it's we're gonna like I know people that work on software that currently will change backgrounds and stuff. So you, when you watch an old version of say the TV show Friends, they will change the paintings on the walls to be something else. And they can say, you know what, we can put in that, and why don't we change the cereal boxes to be this new cereal box and the magazine. And so putting advertising in that way and go modifying stuff. And I don't know, do I like that? Do I not like that? Is that a bad thing? I mean, these are all issues that I sort of wrestle with. But mostly it's when I can't fast forward my DVDs, I freak out. So,
but I was going to say, lastly, I think what we all care about when it comes to, I guess, especially media of entertainment or whatever, so movies and music and maybe even books, is that you want it when you want it. And if we have access to it anytime we want it, we're probably happy with that. But then, but you're right, none of us, I think, can fully believe that it's going to always stay that way. We don't feel totally comfortable.
Or they just take it away.
Yeah.
You go to Netflix and say, I want to watch that show. Oh, no, now it's gone.
Can we really trust it that, oh, you mean I don't have to buy this? I can really get it from you anytime I want it? You know, and I know it's like when you're a kid and a friend, you know, your best friend gets a toy or something and you have access to it, then you have a fight. Now, you know, I thought I'd always have access to your toy, but now you don't play with them for a while.
And frankly, this is a larger issue for those of us outside the U.S. because it's often the case that media is more U.S.-based and created more in the U.S. when we're talking about things like books and TVs and that, and movies, mass media. And we have different licensing for our countries. And so it'll often be the case that suddenly some show will be on Netflix and no, now it's gone because they lost the right to play it in our country, or there's a dispute over something or what have you. So we, when you're outside of the U.S., you take all the more gamble that somebody will just take all those things away, where if you, and suddenly you're just like, oh, you don't get that anymore. Or suddenly everything from a particular brand is gone or has different licensing, or you have to watch a commercial in front of it now or something.
Hey, Earl, let me mention one more quick thing. We don't have to talk about it, but essentially there was another interesting article in Computer Shopper. So when I scanned in the one Stan Veit editorial, I put it at the bottom. So anybody, if you go to the link and read it, you could, it's interesting too, because again, from April 89, it says Intel announces 1 million transistor superchip. And apparently this chip never came to be, because it mentions how the 486 was already under development. And anyway, that is not backwards compatible. So I don't think that's the Pentium. But it's kind of a short, it doesn't give you a lot of details, but
I think it implied it was a RISC-based chip.
Yeah, maybe so.
Anyway, 1,000, what is it, 1 million transistors? Who would ever need that many transistors?
You'd never, I mean, you could never use that many transistors. There'd be, you know, 500,000 just going to waste.
Frankly, I don't think 1 million is actually a real number. So I'm not believing this. I'm not that gullible. Nice try, David.
You know, it's interesting, though, looking back to see, I mean, it... You know, over the years, it hasn't always been so, but Intel very often has been on the edge of innovation. I mean, they just introduced that new, you know, 3D sort of fabrication technology that's going to allow them to push Moore's Law even further. And it's kind of interesting to look back to the late 80s and see, yeah, essentially the same thing going on. Hey, we've tweaked our processes to get this. I mean, that company's been doing a lot of stuff for a very long time.
And interesting things happen when you're in manufacturing, as Intel is, and you're having to push the physical limitations of the world, where they're making chips and they're saying, but if we make this any smaller, photons can't fit through, they'll leap from left to right. And that's an interesting thing that humanity comes up against. So I love companies that are on that edge of production.
Mm-hmm. I was trying to find a transistor count for Pentium, for the original Pentium. Maybe what the Pentium ended up being was sort of a mixture of that initial thing. Anyway, it said the original Pentium had 3,100,000 transistors, 1993.
Totally.
Yeah. And it didn't.
And it I'm didn't going come back to that counting that where later. You do the. No, I want the counting where you do like 1, 2, 3, many. It has many transistors.
Yeah, the 486 had 1,180,000.
Lies.
Four times more than the 386.
Yep, no, we're not buying it, David.
No, David, nice try.
Didn't
Us
happen.
And the listeners are not that gullible. Did not happen.
It's like that whole moon stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know if you guys know this, but most of the movie Capricorn 1 was actually filmed on the moon.
Right. No, they was filmed in the same studio where they faked the moon landing.
Oh, I knew it was something like that. Yeah.
Save money.
There's actually been web pages where people are using pictures from the movie Capricorn 1 as evidence of the faked. Look, it's a studio. See, this is where they filmed it.
Oh, man. Awesome. I'm going to move us along before we start getting hate mail. VCF East 7.0. It happened, what, last weekend?
But it didn't happen to me.
Yeah.
I didn't get to go. I was scheduled to go up until like 2 days before it, and I ended up having to work that weekend, and I'm so disappointed. I have wanted to go to this event. Well, this is the seventh one. I guess I've wanted to go seven times in a row, and I've never been able to attend.
You still got my T-shirt, though, right?
I did not get you anything. I got you a million t-shirts.
What?
Imaginary number of t-shirts. Oh, I'm so disappointed. And I'm, you know, as you guys know, and as our listeners probably know, I skew very strongly towards the Apple II area of vintage computers. And a number of folk in the Apple II community did get to attend. And so I missed out doubly this year. Oh, it looked like a great event.
Yeah, I'll put a bunch of links in the show notes to different pictures they've been posting. I've tweeted a number of them. And yeah, there's quite a good presence of Apple II there. And Commodore. Earl.
Well, you know, the thing that impressed me was it looked like a tower of Apple monitors.
Yeah.
In those photos that I saw. And I don't know exactly what that was all about, but it looked really cool.
Yeah. The VCS in general are really fun-looking events, and I cannot wait to eventually attend one of them. I think there's a relationship between these and what we were talking about earlier, the hackerspace and stuff, and I think they're a kinship sort of movement, but this one clearly skewed towards more vintage things, but in a sense, the you know, keeping it running, and so I see a lot of overlap in the mentality behind the two.
Mm-hmm. Just curious if anybody had a chance to speak with Evan. Since then, I was curious, you know, what the headcount was and overall. It sure looked like from the photos that I saw that people were enjoying the event and it was well attended.
I haven't spoken to him. I am a member of the March, you know, of the group that he's in, the Mid-Atlantic Retro Computing Hobbyists. So, you know, so I get the email updates on their message forum. And anybody can join that that's interested, even if you don't live in that area and you can't physically, you know, attend a lot of things they're doing. But I don't, he hasn't announced that stuff yet.
I got the impression it was very well attended, though. From the photographs and from the coverage, it looks like it was one of the most well attended ones so far.
Mm-hmm. But that's where I've been getting the links for pictures and one little video and stuff that I've tweeted. So, again, I'll put those in the show notes.
I think that they were expecting, actually, Carrington, to have a banner year. This year.
Nice.
So,
also, of course, we're at a point where these events are often publicized more, and the nature of having digital photographs and little video cameras, that kind of stuff, and means of publishing through sites like YouTube, that kind of stuff. I think we get to experience a lot more of these events when we don't attend them. Like, say, last year's Kansas Fest, I got to watch lots of videos and see lots of photographs of that having not attended, but there's really nothing for Kansas Fest from 10 years before that, except a couple of small photos. So that probably also gives us a different impression of the events after the fact.
Are you definitely going to that, Carrington?
Well, I have paid for it, so hopefully I'm going.
Okay.
Otherwise, I'm and I will be taking part in that. There's going to be the MP3, you know, make your own MP3 card.
Oh, with Vince Briel, right?
Yeah, with Vince. So I have signed up for that as well. So I'll be bringing down my soldering stuff. I'm really looking forward to it.
And I just want to – I'm looking up the date again just since we're talking about it.
I think it's about two months from now. It's July, third week of July, something like that.
Because I'd put these other VCFs in the show notes.
But, I had attended once before. I think it was maybe the 2006 one or something. And it was an absolutely incredibly fun event. So I cannot wait.
July 19th through 24th.
Yeah, it normally goes like a Tuesday through a Sunday, though the Tuesday is the move-in day, so it's a bit of stuff that, and then the Sunday it's only like a half day, it's a move-out day. It's really the Wednesday through Saturday are the meaty days of the event, but incredibly fun event.
And, you know, they mentioned us on the Open Apple podcast that came out a week ago.
Which is a great podcast. I really like Open Apple.
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah. So I guess to just throw this in, though, that we're going to be down one Apple podcast because of the unfortunate passing of Ryan Suenaga, who was a very big, big name in the Apple community and like an incredibly, I don't know what to say, like prolific, what do you say? Like, I mean, produced hardware, he produced software, he helped run events. I mean, just a huge force in the Apple II family. And unfortunately went hiking and tumbled off the cliff. So in Hawaii. So just a few weeks ago and really shook up the Apple community. I think that's an unfortunate thing about the vintage computer movements in general is we do also skew kind of older. I mean, Ryan was only, I think, a year older than me, but as a community, we lose people every year, it seems, just because we skew so much older than a lot. So
I want to say he was either 44 or 46. One
something
of those
like
two
that.
Dates.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ages.
So not exactly. I think that's also another reason why it made such big news, because there's been a few large names in the Apple II community over the last couple of years who have had fortunately passed, but when they're older, it's no less tragic, but it's a little less surprising maybe than somebody who just goes hiking and is gone. So I think that's why it hit people maybe a little harder in the news. But yeah, I met him once at Kansas Fest, and he was a really nice guy. So it's really a shame he won't be there this year.
And let me just say, his podcast is called A2 Unplugged. Mm-hmm. So if you go to a2unplugged.com, you can...
Is the site up? It was having some difficulty, and I worry that it's a renewal problem.
It just came up. It just came up for me. Well, it came up with something like if your browser is not forwarded or something.
Oh, it does. Yeah, that was the nature of the setup. I think it was a WordPress setup.
Yeah, so... So yeah, anyone.
That's an issue, though. That's something I don't know if you guys have thought about, but a lot of us here, back to the cloud computing idea. A lot of us have our lives very much on the net with mm-hmm. blogs, with podcasts, with all those things. And how much of that is ephemeral and will simply vanish when we're no longer paying domain renewal fees?
Right, right.
So how long does this stuff stay around? I mean, thank goodness for archive.org, I guess.
Well, that's true. I have an archive version of all of my podcasts, including, you know, the original source audio and that kind of thing that I keep locally. So if something were to happen to Libsyn, then that, you know, obviously it would not be possible to go out and get the podcasts anymore. But I've got them and I could repost them or whatever. I try not to use the cloud for any kind of storage exclusively.
Yeah. It's not safe.
No, it can go away.
I do that now, but I didn't with my very first blog. I've had my own domain name for ages. I started blogging, you know, crazy long number of years ago, 94 or something like that, I think, because the current archive maybe goes back to that, or 96 or something. But previous to that, very, very early on, I was hosted through a local, I think they were, it was io.org. And I think they were a nonprofit group, and they simply lost their funding and it vanished. And I was one of the first people to sign up for that. So I got the email address just C. I just wanted the number letter C. So I was just c@io.org. It was very and that whole blog, a little thing called SeaWorld, I had up for 4 or 5 years. And all of that just vanished overnight and I had no backup. So I was like, oh, that was something I guess I should have thought of. So, I mean, my first blog was through a BBS hosted thing. I think it started in 89 and then that one went 89 to 93 or something. And then all of that just, I was a much more prolific blogger back then, but then it all just sort of vanished. I was like, oh, that was a foolish mistake. They just had a drive failure and then lost their funding. So subsequently to that, I've done the same thing Earl has where I have local copies of everything now.
And then, you know, just to throw this out, because we're on the topic, me being in technical support roles, and I used to do freelance stuff with, you know, regular consumers and people. I mean, I constantly preach to people, the most mechanical thing in your computer is that hard drive, and it will fail one day. Absolutely. Just, it's a matter of when. And I feel bad for the, you know, modern people that've got these gigantic hard drives. Every part of their taxes for the last few years, all their, you know, their email, every picture they've taken for the last 5 years, it's all on that one device, and it's going to fail. Mm-hmm. It's a time bomb. And if
I
you don't
we talked about
it up,
that last show, yeah.
Yeah, maybe so. Sorry.
No, I agree. No, it's a big topic, though. I totally agree.
That's what I say. I preach it every time it comes up, because it's like, just don't take it for granted. You know, have at least two copies or more.
Mm-hmm. Well, for just a moment, imagine it's 1978. And I'm sitting in my...
Wait, hold on. I'm thinking of how young I am.
Awesome. Yeah,
I'm looking forward to Star Wars. I have
exactly.
hair. Oh, my goodness.
Exactly. So I'm sitting in middle school, you know, which at the time was called junior high. And it's in the computer, not computer science room, but the computer mathematics room. Mm-hmm. And I'm saving my Apple II game onto the cassette. And suddenly somebody walks by and kicks out the power cord. Now, I want to tell you guys, this is not a hypothetical event. This is a real event. And I had
You're still
spent
upset about this, are you?
weeks on that game. And I had not ever had the foresight to copy it to another cassette just in case something like that would happen. So it got kicked out halfway. I didn't have another copy. It was only half recorded. I could never retrieve it. So I learned in the late 80s the value of backups and have
you
never forgotten it since.
You probably learned in the late 80s that we should have never left punch cards. 70s. You still would have had most of them. You still would have had them punched.
I said 80s, but I meant 70s. Late
right.
70s. I learned never to... We did have punch cards, and occasionally they would fall on the floor, and if you didn't have them numbered, you'd be trying to resequence 200, you know, punch cards by by
I remember
memory.
Doing that many times, and
but at least they were there, you know, whereas right. this magnetic storage stuff, I never trusted, you know, anything shy of a chisel and stone after that to permanently
or a printout for me early on for programming. It was I print it as well, and at least I can always just type it all back in.
We didn't even have a printer. connected to the Apple II. The Apple II was there out of the goodness of the heart of our instructor, who couldn't get the school district to buy one, so he brought his own personal one in for us to play
nice
with.
Teacher.
Something that I will never forget and, you know, am eternally grateful for. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, no printer, no nothing, you know, no single luxury like Robinson Crusoe.
Like Robinson Crusoe?
Exactly.
I love that those theme songs from 60s television shows.
They're very memorable. You know, I did want to mention before we got off the topic one more thing about Ryan Suenaga, that not only in the Apple II community was he well known as someone who was, as you say, Carrington, prolific and also always willing to extend a hand and help, but apparently just in general in life, this was his approach as well. That,
yeah, it's kind of sad that I learned all that too, but only after his passing, reading so much that he did to help people. I agree.
Didn't know that, life / social stuff until after his passing, but, you know, definitely a great guy, very tragic and a loss to the retro computing community. So yeah, shout out to those who knew him and definitely will miss him.
He was actually a social worker.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was trying to get him on this show, and I was just looking for the email, but he wasn't able to because I know he had a relative, I think an elderly relative, that he was actually caretaking for with.
Yes.
Or, you know, and so.
Yeah, very sad thing.
You know, and on the topic, switching gears here a little bit on the Vintage Computer Festival stuff, if you didn't get to go to Vintage Computer Festival East, there are other Vintage Computer Festivals, apparently, that you could attend. And, David, you put up information on a couple of them here.
Just to mention, because I know we're getting a little tight on time, but just since we're on this topic, yeah, there's two more coming up, so they've been officially announced as, go. So there's the second Vintage Computer Festival Southwest, which is announced by Gil Carrick, the director of the Museum of Information Technology at Arlington, Texas, and that is August 6th and 7th. So I guess going in order, Kansas Fest is next in July, and then this one is August 6th and 7th, which I assume is a Saturday and Sunday. I didn't put it in the notes there. And so this is at the Hereford University Center at UT Arlington. And then there is the 6th Vintage Computer Festival Midwest in Chicago, which starts 8 a.m. Saturday, September 24th, to 4 p.m. Sunday, September 25th. If I'm not mistaken, too, the one in Chicago, I believe, in the past it's only been one day. I could be wrong, but so now it's 2 days. And that one is in, if you go to the link, it's in conjunction with the Chicagoland Commodore Expo, which, I thought they used to call it the Emergency Chicagoland Commodore Convention. So whether or not it's still called that.
Yeah, the ECCC.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was, these two groups, and they do it together now, having started that last year. So it looks like a lot of fun. So I don't know if I can make it, but might be good.
Yeah, I got to save money in the piggy bank to be able to get to some of these shows. I mean, it just seems like there's more and more of them, which is a good thing. Lots more opportunities. But, you know, they never seem to be within striking distance of the West Coast here.
Yeah, you need one up in your – because, you know, there is the one that was in California, which as it stands right now, I guess Salem Ismail. I get that right. It's kind of on hold still. But you need one in the Northwest.
It's funny that there isn't.
Yeah, there's got to be – So Earl,
it is kind of strange that there isn't one in the the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah,
and to be honest, I've actually, thought about the idea of trying to get one going. But man, talk about doing a podcast and the amount of work there. The amount of effort to put one of these together is fairly gargantuan. But you know, there'd be a huge amount of interest because we're in the Silicon Forest here, and up in Seattle, obviously, lots of underpinnings of the computer community. So I'm sure there'd be a lot of people who would want to jump in and attend and help out and that kind of thing. So yeah, I hope one materializes someday, and who knows, maybe one day I'll get ambitious and put one together. But man, yeah, that's quite a time commitment.
Well, I hope to start one here for the Southeast in the greater Atlanta area, and I'm working on that, though I think a more realistic in the approach, because I'm building the Historical Computer Society group, and I think so. Basically, I'm kind of following what Evan Koblenz did in New Jersey with March. I think it's maybe better to. I know we had a conversation about this, Earl. Kind of build a little club first, and then that mm-hmm. then that can help, you know, get an expo going.
Exactly. I totally agree. Yeah, I think as well, if anybody out there is interested in starting up something, I agree that taking it on yourself would be almost impossible. So the way to start would be either to form a small club, or I would think to wrap up a few of the topics we've talked about, to go and join one of the local hackerspaces. Like, yeah. I know there's two hackerspaces here in Toronto, for instance. And so I would think instead joining one of those, which is sort of going to give you a little monthly meetup, and then through that you could float the idea of, hey, why don't we do something more for the general public and have a little, like, for instance, in Toronto, then they had a little mini Maker Faire a couple weeks ago prior to the big Maker Faire. So I think that's the way, if you were interested in having a local VCF or something like that, is to start with a club and then see who else would be interested in helping you form one up.
Well, and you know, there certainly is a seed of vintage computing interest in the Portland area here, because we've got not one but two Commodore clubs that meet regularly and do lots of exciting things. And so, you know, there's definitely, like I say, retro computing energy being expended here in the Northwest. Mm-hmm. So, you know, might be some people there who would want to help out. So I don't know, definitely something to think about, but I'm kind of sad that all these things are so far away from me. There's nothing that's even, you know, remotely within driving distance.
I'm a Canadian, cry me a river.
So Earl, not being, you know, totally clear on where Portland is, I was looking at the map. So I say Olympia, Washington. That's where you should. That's a little bit closer to Seattle, but it's in between Portland and Seattle. That's where the first Pacific Northwest Computer Vintage Computing Expo ought to take place.
Olympia, huh? That's a thought.
I don't know. It seems like a nice place. It's on a body of water.
I don't know much about Olympia, other than I've just driven through on my way to Seattle.
Well, just, you know, get on I-5.
About 2 hours to the north of me. Yep, yeah. It absolutely is. So, all right. Well, in the interest of time, we should probably move forward. You mentioned that, David, and you're right. Got to keep plugging along here.
Yeah, sorry, backseat driver. Oh,
it's good. It's good. Got to keep me honest. So we got a couple more conversation topics here. I say that we just kind of hit them on a ricochet, you know, not spent too long on them. But an interesting discussion came up on Slashdot. A well-known news site for nerds, whether people who are interested in running old DOS games should run them in the well-known DOS emulator called DOSBox, or whether they should get a real DOS space box. In other words, get a real computer to run them on. And it brought up for me the age-old discussion that has come up when people have chatted with me, you know, vis-a-vis Retrobits, on whether or not emulation is fantastic and the cool way for people to experience things that they couldn't otherwise, or whether emulation is awful and evil, and, you know, we should definitely stay away from emulation because the only way to do it right, by golly, is to do it on real hardware. And, you know, you could imagine the comments on this Slashdot article.
580.
Yeah, there were a lot, and they kind of did go both ways. And, of course, like Slashdot conversations do, often went off on side roads and, you know, sideways and different directions as well. I mentioned that if you go to this link, Slashdot conversations are not always family or work safe. So you got to watch out there. But it was, though, fascinating that they brought that up. And I don't know, what do you guys think?
I hate being the voice of reason because it's so much more interesting for me to take extreme stances. But here, I got to say, I think both are good and both are appropriate. I do both. I like playing Apple games and using Apple software on a vintage actual Apple II, and I like the box software. And if it's shrink-wrapped, then I can know all the better. But you only have so much space and only have so much money, and if I can't have every sort of system under the sun, so I will use emulation for everything else. And I think that the compromise stance here is probably the best one. I mean, it's really fun to play with vintage hardware, but it's also a little more difficult. And if you just want to, if you don't want to dedicate a whole room to it, it's both financially and just space-wise usually untenable. And so having great emulation offers things you simply wouldn't get otherwise. That's what I say.
You use better words than me.
You need to be good.
Untenable. I totally agree with you, Carrington. I think
because I am a wise and well-spoken fellow.
Yeah, I am bowing to you as we speak.
Well, then I'm changing my mind. And emulation is evil.
No, I just think that, exactly, there's a compromise. I think old hardware should be respected and it should be valued and we should try to preserve it. And when we move into the eBay auctions, this is kind of where I was going with what I chose this time around, is that, you know, for the longest time, old PCs are such commodity items. Well, and I know we're talking more than just about PCs, but for one example, you know, but they're not anymore. Most of them are trash now, so they're becoming rare, even old generic 286s and stuff. Mm-hmm. But so in general, old hardware should be valued and try to be preserved, but all the stuff is going to stop working at some point. Eventually, you know, when I'm a real old man, and all of us are, I think the large majority of all these microcomputers and personal computers, though, they're going to be nice, pretty... What am I trying to say? You know, the look at. You can't use them anymore.
The disks are going to deteriorate. And
well,
not
and the hardware. And so you can clean
and
them
the
up.
And the monitors stop working.
And look, this is a beautiful example of an Apple Lisa. No, it doesn't turn on. Sorry. But mm-hmm. You know, this is what it looks like. But yeah,
they're going to be just museum pieces. Yeah.
But the user experience, you can fully have that through emulation and through the real software and so on. So you're not really selling out or compromising, I think. You kind of have the best of both worlds, or it's just the reality of the situation.
Maybe that'll be the case, though. Maybe there's going to be a market for people that make emulating systems, but built into the cases of vintage computers. If you have an Apple II and the motherboard's destroyed, why not take a modern PC, build it inside there, and then you get the – I mean, really, at the end of the day, though, what would be the difference? If it literally was exactly the display and you couldn't tell – I mean, for all I know, that's how my Apple II works now. I haven't opened it up for a bit.
Well, I hope to see a lot more reproductions, like my Altair Micro from Vince Briel. I want to see more of that. Someone, you know, make a reproduction Lisa. Maybe it could be smaller. Well, it doesn't matter. You know, and put the emulator inside there. That would be cool.
And also how extreme do you make it? Like I use vintage Apple II computers, but I rarely feel the need to put on a pink popped collar, you know, Lacoste t-shirt when I do it. But I would need to do that if I want the full real 80s experience.
Yeah.
In fact, I probably have to wear two of those shirts at the same time. And something from Ocean Pacific.
I remember in one of your 1 megahertz
I talk nonsense in that show. Don't listen to it.
Yeah. Let's see if I get it straight. Was it Load Runner where you would play? You played. Wait a minute. Wait. Don't tell me. Don't say it. Don't say. Wall of Voodoo CD.
Wall of Voodoo. Call of the West. Wall of Voodoo. Yes, on repeat because I had that CD or the album at the time.
I loved that album, by the way.
And I associate the game and the album so strongly. I have to do.
Earl, are you familiar with it?
You guys are killing me. I'm going to have to go out and buy a pair of Vans just so that I can, you know.
Here, let me move the microphone up.
Well, if we ever switch this to a video podcast, we will have to dress appropriately.
Radio.
Radio. Yep, absolutely. Yeah, great album.
Well done.
All right.
Okay. Well, hey, speaking of which, let's actually talk about the eBay auctions. Mentioned the previous eBay auctions. Carrington, you had the Apple II GS 11 megahertz transwarp, you know, like the, you know, USS Excelsior, you know.
And a good version of it. Like there's a few different versions of the transwarp. This was a good one and with the faster speed and stuff. And I believe it sold for, I think, $400 or something. So, and it didn't sell to me. I was sorely tempted to purchase that item, but I did not.
Yeah, $400.
Yeah, I kind of wish I did purchase it, but $400 is a lot of money to pour into a 2GS, but holy cow, that's a nice accelerator. The other item I had picked, I think, went for crazy money if it sold. I can't remember what the other item was, though. I should look at the show notes.
Oh, here it is. Personal software. Oh, wait. Where is it? Here it is. Zork personal software Apple II.
Yes, it was the original Zork version from before Infocom. Did not sell because they were asking... roughly $1 million if I round up. One of those imaginary huge numbers.
$2,500, buy it now, or $1,995. You know, if they just would bring it down, you know, $1,895, you know.
That's so much money to spend on essentially a folder. Very collectible item, but not that collectible. So, alas.
Well, it looks like my pet interfacing book also sold for $1,695, so that's cool. And what did yours do, David?
Oh, let me look. See, a Commodore 128 working system, disk drive, disk slot, $66.
Yep. Not surprising.
That's pretty good. Well,
cool.
Yeah, $50 shipping. Well, that would be to me. It was in New York. Okay. Yeah, not bad.
So on the new stuff, Carrington, you've got to win the award for the most retro.
Well, it's a computer, in a sense.
Wow.
Device ever.
But it's a computer from 1889, yes.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Now, it's technically an adder, which is the sort of the forerunners to the adding machine. And adders were little mechanical handheld devices used for, just like it sounds, adding up columns of tables. And if you can imagine everything, all the professions that would use adding machines going into the 20s and 30s, what those same professions used, you know, 50 years before that were adders. Generally, they were comprised of a couple of circles. This particular one is a later version of the web adder. You can sort of tell because it looks like two full circles instead of just two sort of blobs. But how they work is two circles of numbers, and you would use your pencil or a stick, but really just you'd have your pencil or pen, and you would – there's little holes, and you'd put your pencil in, and sort of dial it as if you're dialing an old manual phone to add columns of numbers. And the one wheel would turn the other, and that's how you could quickly add up a bunch of figures. And I've always found them excellent little, you know, vaguely steampunk devices. And I like this particular one. It was nice and shiny. So, yeah.
They look cool. Have you ever actually seen one in person?
Yeah, I've played with them, a couple of them in person. And it's sort of, I mean, it's just what you would think is you just, you know, I want to add a column of 10 or 59. And so you move the little circle to give 50 more and then the big circle to give 9 more. And then it's just slowly turning to add up final numbers. It's just a couple of gears. But they're you know, it's a fun little simple mechanical device. And if you're looking to pick up computer-related or vintage things or change your house into a Victorian steampunk manor, then, you know, these are relatively cheap ways to pick up cool. I'm not sure how collectible, but at least cool devices. This one's, I think, $100 currently, and it has 8 bids, so it'll probably sell for more.
That's really cool. I think it's probably very collectible.
Well, I think it must be because it's got, you know, 4.5 days left to go, and it's already up to $100 with 8 bids.
Yeah.
So
but this
I wouldn't
is a
be
nice,
surprised
very clean
to
one. Yeah,
we'll probably go for much more.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, do you guys see a link I just stuck there, or I just changed it. If you look at this link right below it, my mother used to have, I think, this little device. I think she had one when I was really little that actually used a little stylus. So it was certainly a.
Had one of these. You push the button and it would add things up.
Yeah, as you're going through the grocery store.
The 50s and 60s version of the same thing. Or they used this sort of handheld one that you just linked to, the little plastic one, would be what you'd use to, say, count people coming through gates and stuff. Yeah.
But I kind of remember, I thought maybe she had one before that was more reminiscent of the older one where you had the little holes and used a little stylus thing to forward it versus the buttons, but I could be wrong.
Adders stayed around for ages, but they were, you know, very common devices in the late 1700s, I think 1800s is really, I guess, when they were used mostly. In fact, they're probably only 1800s. I've always just had things that are made of gears and brass kind of appeal to me. And if it has if it's like, you know, a forerunner to vintage computer stuff, it appeals all the more.
Well, cool. Yeah, you definitely take the award for the oldest
and the weird
on the list today. Yeah. Mine are a little newer, but you know, I've got a couple here. One is for an Atari 65XE computer, and the other is for a Commodore 64. So I won't necessarily go into these eBay items in detail because, you know, I snuck two in. But the interesting thing to me is both were new in the box. And the one seller there selling the Atari has sold a bunch of Atari stuff, has very good feedback, you know, and so it's interesting to me. I'm a sucker for computing equipment from back in the day that's new in the box. I will say that you take a risk whenever you do something like this because I remember, you know, I used to sell these things back in the day, and when we'd sell them, they didn't always work out of the box. And so, you know, the QA was better on Atari overall than it was on Commodore, although the Commodore, the guy who's selling this 64 that is claimed to be new in the box, evidently took it out of the box, plugged it in just to make sure that it works, and then put it back. So I love new in the box stuff. So that's why I picked these. It'd be interesting to see how much they go for and what kind of questions they get. I mean, with the Atari thing, like I say, this seller's sold all kinds of stuff. With the Commodore, it'd be interesting with the story that they put on eBay there that, you know, we bought this, wound up just staying in the closet, didn't get used. First time I took it out was just recently here. I bet that they'll get questions on that. Like, you know, people probing to make sure, hey, is this really new in the box, honest, you know, for sure? Because there's, you know, I think that especially with Commodores, how cheap they were there toward the end, that there are many that got taken out, used for a little bit, and then put back in. And they probably wouldn't have a scratch on them, and all the stuff would probably still be kind of minty fresh. But they're not technically, quote-unquote, new in the box. What is it about new in the box that people like so much? I can't. I'm one of them, and I can't explain it.
I can explain it. I think because you wanna re-experience or experience the situation of where you can, you know, pretend I just bought this and it's brand new, and it is.
But the reality is, unless it's still sealed, the difference between new in a box and just in a box is negligible to me. I mean, it's complete in the box is nice, and that's important to get all the elements and stuff. But if you're not opening up the shrink wrap, I don't see a difference between just here's an item and it comes complete with all the original packaging.
Well, also speaking from the standpoint of I don't care about this per se, but I, you know, if I really wanted a Commodore 64 experience of being new in the box, I would expect the box to look brand new too and be sealed, like you say. I think this is what's happened to some of these Apple IIcs and other stuff. And for one thing, a Commodore 64 is so much more common, and I love them, but I don't think this is going to sell for even $200. It's because I don't need to spend $200 for this. I can find one in really great shape for far less. It doesn't have to be new in the box.
Let's face it, this is no Apple II.
Well, I mean, it's more common.
Now, Kill.
I just mean, from a commonality standpoint.
No, it isn't,
because
it's a whole 64K.
Oh, that's more than anybody needs. That's anything over 48 is an unreasonable amount of K.
Did you notice, guys, about the Atari? There's actually three of them for the buy it now price of $75, and they're from Mexico. So it's got Spanish, doesn't it? Well, it's got English, too. But yeah, it says it's from Atari, Mexico. So did they make them for a longer time there, maybe, than
Oh, interesting. I don't know.
In the U.S.?
My problem is that the 600s, you're now into, like we talked about last week, or last show, the Atari models that have those little parallelogram buttons, and I just can't take them.
Right.
Just can't take them.
But the, you know, there seem to be a lot of new-in-box Ataris that are either from, well, they're south of me, let's put it that way, and they're south of the border, because you know, it seemed like there was that one seller that was selling a bunch of them from Venezuela, wasn't it? It was had a bunch of Atari, like the 130 XEs that were from there. So I don't know exactly what the situation was there. It'd be interesting to find out, but you're right, David. It's it's interesting that it comes from that area, but apparently it's just like a U.S. one, except that the printing on the bottom of it is in Spanish. But I think everything else about the model, I don't think you turn it on and it says listo instead of saying ready, you know, at the basic prompt. I think it's, you know, the standard English basic and all that.
All right. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. What about your Tandy, David?
Oh, okay. So, what I decided to look for was, you know, a Tandy 1000. So that's what I chose, a Tandy 1000 HX. See, this one's still got 3 days and 21 hours for $100 buy it now, or you can make an offer. You know, it's in really nice condition. Whether it's worth $100 or not, how much is the shipping to me? 24. That's pretty reasonable. Didn't say where it is, but I'm thinking that these now were. They were almost worthless. I used to see them all the time 10 years ago in thrift stores and stuff. They're now becoming, you know, collectible and desirable. And I think they're becoming more rare because the high majority of them would just get trashed. So I just thought it'd be interesting to follow it and see what happens. And see if you guys, what do you guys think?
There is that
time
kind
has
of
come
weird
for.
There's that kind of weird bell curve where, you know, something is valuable because it's new and usable. And then, you know, for a while, it's just junk. And then all of a sudden, everybody threw them away or recycled them or whatever because they're junk. And now all of a sudden, they're more rare again. I mean, I had an 8088-based computer that I actually just recycled. This was a lot of years ago. But now I'm kind of looking back at that and going,
wish you kept it. Yeah.
Gone it. I wish I, it was an Epson Apex, you know, so it wasn't even a real IBM. It was, you know, this kind of off brand, but doggone it. It had, you know, twin 360K floppy drives. I could have done some cool stuff with that. And now, you know, it's filling up a landfill or the pieces are being parted out somewhere. It kind of makes me sad when I think back on it.
And I think especially Tandy, you know, I almost get a little annoyed with people because anytime I show off a TRS-80, they're always, I mean, they're like universally referred to as trash 80s.
Right.
I guess that's supposed to be a sort of a term of endearment. But, you know, they really get a bad rap. They were great computers and they really, you know, they were good computers and very economical. And Tandy in general made pretty good computers. This little Tandy 1000 was a pretty good deal and was absolutely, a fine computer at the time for what it did. You know, like this example here, you know, DOS-based, it's running their little interface called DeskMate, which is especially nice because it really sets it up as like the way it was at the time. And I have a laptop that has DeskMate on it, you know, a Tandy laptop. And they were decent little computers. It's actually my laptop, I think, is essentially the same thing. Yeah, 3.5-inch disk drives and stuff. But I just think, I guess the time has come for, if you look at the one other link I put there, basically all it is where'd it go? Is I did a search for 8088 in vintage computing category, and you can see some of the prices and things going, you know, that are specifically 8088 CPUs. Most of them are early IBMs, but some of these, I know whether or not they're going to sell, but like here's a Zenith laptop, $130, Panasonic senior partner, $140, a portable Packard Bell, $140. Again, I don't know if they're going to sell for that much, but I guess these things are starting to finally get collectible
Are those buy it nows?
Yeah, on those I just mentioned.
Yeah, I think, you know, because I noticed when I was looking at eBay in preparation for the show that there is a ton of listings that are coming out from the seller Vintage Computer Museum.
Oh, yeah, that are always outrageous.
And I think we've discussed listings from that particular seller on past shows, so I won't, you know, repeat it here. But I bet that some of those that you're seeing are coming out from that seller because there is just like an absolute flood of listings over the last day or two.
Well, if the eBay link to the order I put it in as the highest price first, so all the ones along the top are 5150s and 5160s, the earliest IBMs, for like $900 buy it now, which
oh my goodness.
Is insane. I mean, who's this one from? So this is... Hey, this one's in Great Toronto, Ontario.
Woohoo! So that's $900 metric.
It's $899 Canadian. You can go pick it up in person, Carrington.
And generally, we have a barter system up here that I don't know how many beaver pelts that would be, but you know, there's lots of different ways you can pay up here.
How about back bacon and brews?
Absolutely. I'm eating and drinking that as we speak.
I'm all about the maple syrup. You were just mentioning that on the pre-show.
Yeah, right. Well, and I had my Doug and Bob McKenzie flashback there, Strange Brew movie. I was a big fan.
So, interesting stuff. David, you kind of already have the floor, you know, so why don't you tell us what's up with you?
Well, I started a new job recently, so I used to have a commute that was 29 miles away in Midtown Atlanta, and this is some of the worst traffic in the entire country, which it's bad in a lot of big cities, but it would, on a good day, it would take me at least an hour to get to work and about an hour to get home, but it would take up to 2 hours to get to work sometimes. So now my new job is 19 miles away, and it's outside of Atlanta. Has the big highway system around it like most cities, and so here it's called the perimeter. So I'm just north of the perimeter because I live north of Atlanta. So now I generally can get to work in an hour on the worst days, less time, and usually, you know, an hour home on the absolute worst days in 30 or 40 minutes. So believe it or not, that is, like, awesome. So my life is just greatly improved by that. And it's a good job. I'm happy with it. I'm a tech, so I support Macs and PCs and an environment. It's an advertising agency. Yeah, Carrington, I told you we have an office in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
So the name of the company is Sapient.
Everyone needs an office in Toronto.
Yeah, and there's offices in New York and everything. So I'm happy about that, and I think I'm, you know, so that does a lot to you in your life, changing jobs and stuff. I think you did that recently, Earl, didn't you? Like last year or something? And
It's been a little over a year, and yeah, it is a stressor, even if, you know, the thing that you're going to is awesome, which in my case it was, but it definitely turns things topsy-turvy. I went to zero commute David, actually. And that, you know, the company that I work for now, most of us work out of our home office. So, and that's been really cool and interesting. I find that you do have to impose a certain amount of personal, what would I say, discipline on yourself, you know, because you're working out of the home office. But it's cool.
And so other than that, my life is settling back down, so that's a good thing. You know, I'm behind on my personal projects. I'm like at a dead stop with the Stan Veit podcast, and I just need to get back and finally get that done. But I'm happy. You know, I had my little mini breakdown a little bit, I guess, with this show. But now that we're doing it in this format, that's all much better. So life is good. You know, I got so overwhelmed with the editing thing. So, but yeah, this is great now, and you guys being on our show. So I'll hand it to you, Carrington, or Earl, you go ahead. You take over.
No, Carrington, please.
Oh, well, the usual, lots of retro stuff. Been doing some Apple II things. Been comparing joysticks. I've got a dozen or so vintage joysticks now that I have been playing games with to do a feature on 1 MHz on sort of which ones I like.
I'm not going to show you mine.
It's one of those things where I picked up the joysticks I used as a kid, and also a bunch of others, just a huge collection from eBay and other sources. And now I've just been sort of doing a big joystick shootout that I'll eventually, won't be in the next 1 MHz, but the one after that, it looks like. So that's been a lot of fun. And then, you know, this 1 MHz podcast, I recorded one last week. It'll be edited, come up in the next few days or so, will be the next one. And then there's Double Take, the movie podcast we do, which was on hiatus because my co-host was away in Iceland, but she's back. And so that show got recorded last night and has been edited. So the next one of those will come out today.
So Iceland's even a little north of Canada, right?
Yeah. Surprisingly, there are things north of Canada, heard, but we're a little jealous of them.
Who would have thought?
Yes.
You know, there's a chance that I'll be driving through a huge chunk of Canada, Carrington, but it will be a buddy of mine who just recently moved to Alaska, and in about a month he's going to be coming back to get his stuff and take it up in a trailer, and I'm doing my best to take the trip with him. So
cool.
If that works out, I'll be driving through BC and a lot of the Yukon Territory, right?
Yeah, if you go up the Alaska Highway, then I've only driven that once on a motorcycle trip I took to the Four Corners of North America. And so I went up and down the Alaska Highway, and it's absolutely a gorgeous ride.
That's what I've heard. And we'd be doing it during the summer, so it'd be the right time of year, right?
Nice. Well, it's absolutely the right time if you want to get eaten by bears. No, I'm kidding. Probably you will not be completely eaten by bears.
They'll leave a little bit left.
Yep.
It's just a partial, you know, consumption. That's okay. But, you know,
it's very important to take that trip with people who run slower than you and are in convertibles. And then,
cool.
Then you're gold. No problem.
Good call.
Yes. What about you? What are you up to, Earl?
Well, gosh, on the life front, we've been going through what I'd call a spring cleaning exercise here at home. You know, we got a lot of junk out of the garage. We've been going through each room and getting ready for a mammoth garage sale that we're going to hold. And, you know, my son has outgrown his bunk bed, so we sold that on Craigslist. I got to tell you guys, the power of the internet. We took a picture of the bunk bed, put it on Craigslist. Within an hour, we had somebody email us, and within 2 hours, they were here to actually buy it. It's just fascinating how fast things can go on Craigslist. But anyway, so yeah, just trying to, you know, get the house and our junk and everything ready for that sale. And it's kind of, you guys may relate to this, but in the time when you're cleaning and moving things around, there's a period where things look even more junkier than they did before. Because you're trying to, you know, it's like the puzzle game, right? You're trying to get all the pieces in the right spot. So that's where we're at right now. My gadget room, as we call it, is an absolute nightmare. But
that's what we're doing today. In fact, between the garage and where I sit, the office, it's a disaster in here. And we're doing spring cleaning too today.
It's that time of year. I guess it's spring, so I'm doing it in the right, you know, time frame this time. But on the retro front, one really exciting thing that I was totally stoked about is that I was going through some boxes that I got from a buddy of mine, you know, retro computing stuff, all kinds of old software, and this is a treasure trove, you know, one of these things. But I found a 8-bit capable Ethernet card, and that's been something that I'd actually considered buying one off eBay or whatever, but I found one. I was like, oh, gotta try this. So even though I'm just incredibly busy, you know, I was on a mission. So I popped open my 5155, which is like an XT in a portable box. Mm-hmm. It is actually an XT motherboard in there that IBM just stuck in a box. It looks like a compact. And I put this card in. I got some software running. I actually got the thing on the net.
Nice.
I mean, I used some software called MTCP, and there will actually be a link for it in the show notes. But that software is apparently still being actively updated, and you need a little widgety of software for your Ethernet card called a packet driver. It's kind of like a universal software interface, and if you've got that packet driver, there's a lot of other pieces of software that can interface to it. So long story short, I actually got on there and FTP'd out to some public FTP sites. You know, I'm on the internet with my IBM XT. So it was actually a wonderful experience, and I'm looking forward to doing more things with that, actually.
Did you – I know we had texted or emailed, I think. Did you did you find anything like a text-based browser or anything that you can use on it?
Well, there might be one with that MTCP package, but if there isn't, I'm pretty sure that there is one that you can – I didn't yet, to answer your question, but – I believe that there is out there a little browser that you can use with a DOS-based situation and a packet driver interface. It's kind of interesting that, you know, with these old TCP/IP applications that run on an 8088 or beyond, usually you just have the packet driver, and then a lot of the TCP stack is built into the application. So you've got to have like a little text-based config file that you put in your IP address and NetMask, or, you know, some of the more advanced ones will even do DHCP, which this MTCP does. But so I'll go out and I'll look for, see if there's a version of maybe like Lynx, the text-based browser, and see if I could find one. Wouldn't that be cool to just be able
Absolutely.
To... You wouldn't be able to do a whole lot with it, but you could say, hey, I'm surfing the internet with my PC XT.
Yeah, and Earl, here's what I was, while you're talking, I was looking for this. Have you ever heard of RetroNet? If you go to retro-net.org, RetroNet is an internet portal geared towards users of obsolete computer systems.
Oh, cool.
I have an account on RetroNet.
Yeah, so, me too, and I haven't used it too much, but yeah, so I'll put that link in the show notes. That's,
I don't have an account on RetroNet.
That's cool.
Oh, I want one. All the cool kids have an account there.
Can't you actually telnet to it, David?
Yeah, exactly. I've done it a couple of times. Access to World Wide Web via the Lynx browser, internet, email, newsgroup access with Pine, personal web space, personal Gopher space, file transfers. But you can telnet access to the master control program shell.
Yep. Awesome. I'm telneting in right now. You have to telnet to create an account. Very cool.
And the cool thing is, I know for sure that with this MTCP package that I just talked about, that there is a Telnet client. So I am totally on the web, David.
I want to do that.
You just reminded me of how I could, take the next step. You know, the next thing you know, I'll be, I probably won't be running Portal 2 on my PC.
Hey, speaking of retro, I'm about to buy Portal. I guess it's kind of retro.
Oh, the original?
Yeah, it's only $10 on Steam, and so we're gonna try it out.
Which original Portal? I'm lost here a bit.
The game called Portal.
Oh, I didn't know if you meant the old game Portal from the 80s.
Oh, no, the one by the guys that made Half-Life.
It is so good. You haven't played Portal yet?
No.
Oh, it is fantastic.
And I could play Portal 2 on my Mac or my wife's, but like my sons want to play it too, so we have a Mac Mini, to the TV. That's just a Core Duo. So Portal will play fine on it. I don't think Portal 2 will. So also, Portal 2 is like $50. I'm not ready to buy that yet. Right. We'll try the $10 first one.
You'll get hooked. It's a fantastic game with a great ending, like one of the all-time great game endings. Love it.
Yeah, I love that company. I played Half-Life and then Half-Life 2 and one other one. Can't think of it, but and I'm not a big gamer, so I've liked their games.
Well, if you like to stretch your mind, you're going to like Portal, because mm-hmm. it stretches your concept of self in space. Mm-hmm. And and I'm not going to give away the ending, but I'm with Carrington that that ending is epic. Yeah. I don't use that, even though that word is in vogue, I don't use it very often. But yeah.
And you have to stay through the whole thing. Basically, it's one of those stay with the credits. Listen to the credits. Like,
absolutely.
Oh, so good.
Yep.
So good.
You got to do it.
I'll put the demo for the original Portal, the YouTube, on the links too, because it's just fun. If anyone has not heard of this or know what we're talking about, it's 2 minutes and 22 seconds. Just watch this demo at least.
It's so good.
Awesome.
The main enemy you're up against, GLaDOS, which is a sentient computer, and not just sentient, but also passive aggressive, and just so good. Yeah, very funny.
Okay. Yeah, Portal, got to play it. I'll be, you know, the next time we get together, David, I'll be interested to see what your impressions are so far. You might actually have finished it by then. You know, the one criticism that people had of Portal is that it's not a long game. It won't take you forever to finish it. But
the thing is, like most people, I played it because it just came as part of the Orange Box. I picked up the Orange Box because it was a great way to get a couple of games and get more licenses for older games. And Portal was just one of the games sort of thrown in there, I think, as almost like a bonus game. And I didn't play it for quite a while until I was just sort of, you know, hey, there's nothing else to play. Let me try that. And it was incredible.
That was my impression, too, because it was a Christmas a few years ago. I was debating buying a friend of mine who just got a PS3.
Mm-hmm.
And the Orange Box, I don't remember the game I got him instead, which I should have got him the Orange Box, actually. But then I was looking at it, I'm like, oh, this is pretty cool, and Half-Life 2, but, you know, Portal, it just didn't, they didn't really stress it that much when it first came out. My impression, anyway.
Yeah, but it was a fantastic game.
Well, and I actually got in on it on this weekend that Steam was giving it away for free.
Oh,
nice.
So they, you know, it was a very fixed amount of time, but, you know, they had an
Steam
article on it.
Steam is great for that. Holy cow, is Steam good for sales on games.
Yeah, definitely. So that's how I got into the Portal world. And I want to play Portal 2 so badly, but I just can't pop for the $45 right now. But I'm working up to it, though.
Yeah.
It'll come down.
I hope so. Hope they have a sale. That,
oh, they totally will. Steam always does. There'll be some sort of sale where they say, okay, for $50 you get these 5,000 games.
Yeah.
I'll put the link to Steam.
Cool. What do you think, guys? Any parting shots here? I think we're over time, but,
yeah.
You know, good show as always, though. I really, you know, enjoyed it.
Yeah.
David, any kind of parting crack at the bat here?
No, I think I'm good.
All right. Carrington?
No, I'm good. I appreciate any listener who actually hung on for the 5 or 6 hours this show has taken.
Yeah. I think it's about 1:20, actually, will be the final show time. Looks like
it's not bad. We're creeping down to an hour, aren't we? You know? We'll get there.
I know. I know there's an argument about long shows, but I just stop it and I go do whatever I'm doing and then take it up again on my commute home or whatever. I just, one last thing I want to say is that everyone, please email us. We haven't set up a generic one yet, but just email me, david@classiccomputing.com, and I will send it out to Carrington and Earl too. Let's get some more feedback from people.
Mm-hmm.
And please, rate us on iTunes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Rate us if you're going to rate us well.
Yeah, if you're going to rate us badly, then maybe.
Otherwise, go away. I don't want your opinion.
All right. Well, thanks to everybody for listening. And we will catch you next time on the Retro Computing Roundtable. David Carrington, always a pleasure.
My pleasure too, Earl.
See ya.